Welcome to this week's episode. We've got Tony Wrighton. Tony is a personal development author and presenter, and one of the country's foremost experts on NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. He's best known for his top-rated podcast, Zestology, which focuses on living life with energy, vitality, and motivation. I actually had the privilege of coming on his show. We did a back-to-back where we recorded mine and then his. It was awesome. On top of that, he's also written 3 books, and if that wasn't enough, Tony is a popular presenter on Sky Sports in the UK. On this episode, Tony shares how he was this hard-driving guy, as you can tell from that bio, and eventually he hit a wall. He was in a chronic state of fight or flight, and it left him unable to fight off a very serious virus. From this experience, he began to reassess his goals, from living this hard-driving life to learning about letting go and acceptance. Listen in for his story, awesome tips on NLP, and the daily practices he has created in his life to how to have it all without having that chronic, constant fatigue that comes with it. I'm sure you're going to love today's episode. Thanks so much for listening. Welcome to this week's episode. Today we've got Tony Wrighton. He's a presenter, host, and author. He is currently the host of the popular podcast Zestology. Hey, Tony, how are you?
Hey, Laura. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Oh, I'm so excited to chat with you. I'm a huge fan of NLP, so I can't wait to hear your
thoughts. Good. Yeah, this might turn into a bit of an NLP geek fest, but that's fine by me.
It may. I'm a little obsessed. So, Tony, I was, checking out your website, and your stuff is so beautiful, so amazing, from your course to your podcast. But I was actually intrigued by this question of how you're doing sports, you're on TV, talking about sports, how you moved over to podcasting and then eventually, over to NLP and podcasting. So can you kind of give us a bit of a backstory?
Yeah. I mean, I'm still doing both. So I've been a Sky Sports presenter here in the UK for almost 10 years, and I'm still doing that. That's kind of 3.5 days a week. And I've just been recording a golf show earlier today. And then I came back here and I got a little podcast set up in the flat. And the reason that I started podcasting really was because I've been involved in NLP for quite a long time and actually started learning NLP back when I worked in radio, probably, almost 15 years ago. Whoa. And I got a 3-book deal to write books on NLP. And in fact, I left the job at Sky for a while to write on NLP. And then everything was kind of going pretty well. And life kind of overtook me a little bit. And you alluded to the fact that I've got a lot going on. Well, maybe I had a little bit too much going on. I went on holiday to the Philippines in the middle of nowhere in this beautiful place in the jungle. And there was nothing more to worry about on this holiday than the sound of the birds chirruping outside one's log cabin every morning as you woke up, and whether to, do a yoga or Pilates class or just lie in the sun and enjoy, a dip in the pool and that kind of thing.
Yeah, unfortunately,
yeah, it was amazing, but it wasn't amazing for me, Laura, because I got really ill in the jungle.
Oh, no.
And I picked up some kind of tropical virus, and I started getting numb patches on my face. I had a rash all down my leg.
Oh, no.
Every bone in my body hurt, and I had to come home really quickly and kind of get seen by neurologists and doctors. And they said, well, we know you've got a virus. And I said, great, what virus? And they said, we don't really know. There are some viruses that modern medicine just hasn't discovered yet.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, it was really bad. So my bosses at Sky were so understanding, and I ended up having 3 months where I couldn't go to work at all. I was just in bed for 3 months. Really, truly, honestly, I didn't know if I would get back to full fitness. And at one of my lowest ebbs, I actually had the idea for the podcast title. And then I thought, Zestology, that'll be good. If I ever do get back to full health, I'd love to do a podcast where I could just focus on how people live with energy and vitality and a kind of zest for life. So that was really the first idea for podcasting. And of course, I worked in radio before, I worked in TV. So I love that side of, chatting to interesting people like yourself. And that's how I got into podcasting, really.
And so you had been doing NLP for 15 years.
Yeah.
And everything was just like flowing along. And that's when you get hit by the virus?
But this is one of the reasons I was really interested in talking to you, because I think NLP, and for people who don't know what NLP is, shall I quickly explain it? Because people always want to know that.
Yes,
and
please.
I know
since we've referenced it.
Before.
Yeah, we've referenced it like 10 times. Go, yeah,
yeah.
Please.
I always have to go over it again because I can barely remember what it means myself. But it's essentially a study of how people do things well and how you can manage your moods and communicate well with yourself and other people. So that's NLP. It's just a bad name. That's all.
Right. I mean, NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. It's like, whew.
Yeah. Yeah. Mouthful. So I've been using the NLP for ages, but I think that people who are type A personalities, are very driven and do a lot in their lives, are attracted to NLP because it helps them get stuff done, right? You know, there's a lot of goal setting in there. There's a lot of communication. There's a lot of kind of, you know, achievement in there. And actually, it turned out that really what I really needed to do was let go. Rather than achieve more, I needed to achieve less, enjoy the fruits of my labor, and just chillax a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was just doing so much. I think, you know, what was really going on behind the scenes when I got ill was there was just such a kind of overstimulation, adrenal overload. My whole body, it just couldn't ever recover because 24 hours a day, I was in fight or flight mode. And of course, you know, everything that led me to NLP in the first place was kind of like, okay, how do we sort this out? I'm ill. What do I need to do to fix it? So I was Googling for 12 hours a day. And as it turns out, you know, Dr. Google can't provide the answers sometimes, you know. And and so actually there was more of an emotional component, which is why I was interested to talking to you. And I found that other things helped more than NLP. NLP, absolutely amazing for so much. And I wouldn't be here now if it wasn't for it. But in this instance, I needed to let go and I needed to accept and I needed to look at the emotions driving that kind of intensity that wasn't helping me get better.
I love that you talk about letting go because I think in our culture of go, 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 more, 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 A personalities, everything you said, the idea of letting go is equated with quitting, weakness, failure. But I found too, that's not the case. When you say letting go, how do you think about that? So the people out there who are like, let go. I mean, you can't do that, right?
It's just so important and it's so hard to do. But essentially, there are only a certain amount of things that you can control in this life. So if you're looking at it in a business context, you might have an idea for a successful business. But ultimately, there's so many factors beyond your control. The world's most successful businessmen of all time have had plenty of failures because they couldn't control everything. You know, Roland Macy opened 7 department stores or whatever it was before he opened Macy's in New York. And all the rest of them went down the pan because he couldn't control people. And then outside the area of work, if you look at relationships or something, as soon as you start trying to control other people, well, that's a recipe for disaster, isn't it? You know, all you can do is accept rather than control. So letting go for me in a health context was to start to say, every time I noticed that my head hurt or my knee hurt, or I felt so tired I couldn't walk down the street, to start to say, okay, well, I accept that that's making me really upset and I accept that it's there. Rather than trying to fight it, just let go because then my body could start to heal.
Yeah, isn't that so powerful? So it's really not about being weak or not trying. It's actually saving your energy in the times that you can influence. As you say, you know, you can't control everything. So save all that energy when you have influence, when you can control, and when you can't, when your knee hurts or the weather or other people.
Yeah.
Right? Don't spend all that energy out there. So when you did this podcast and it's all about living life with energy, vitality, and motivation, was this a lot of what you wanted to get out there?
Well, it was, but what was nice about the podcast was I started it not really knowing that many of the answers, and I've learned so much from the people that I've spoken to and interviewed, like you, because we're recording a double header now, right? So afterwards, I'm going to be able to ask you all these questions. I'm really excited about that. And yeah, I think it was just like a real revelation for so many people to say, look, if you want to achieve more in this life, the way to go about it is not to live your life at a million mile an hour intensity. But if you just sit back and say, meditate for 20 minutes every day, and I know you spoke to the 10% happier guys fairly recently.
Yeah.
If you just take a few minutes every day to step back and do less, you might well find that you're more creative and you have more energy and you achieve more by doing less and letting go and just kind of chilling out and removing yourself from the situation every once in a while. And that's something that with the boundless energy that I had in my 20s and 30s, I didn't really appreciate, but it started to take its toll. And I guess there was a little tipping point. As soon as I got a virus, no doubt about it, but then I couldn't recover because I was just in fight or flight mode all the time. And of course, your body can't heal when you're in fight or flight mode because it thinks it's going to get attacked by a tiger.
Right. And I think so many people are living in this mode all the time and they've adjusted to it, right? You don't even feel bad after a while until eventually, like you said, you collapse or something major happens.
And that's when disease turns up as well, right? Because, you know, your body just gets run down.
I believe so. I mean, medicine hasn't necessarily gone out and said that that's the case, but, you know, they're certainly said the inflammation markers are up, the stress levels, you know, that impacts so much of your body. So, you know, your ability to fight off different illnesses gets, you know, diminished. So how do you incorporate NLP into your life now that you've kind of switched your mode over a bit? Do you still use it on a daily basis? How do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, the NLP, I started studying it almost 15 years ago. I found it really helped me professionally and personally, and I still use it, but I often don't say, I don't say to myself, I must use that NLP technique today to make myself feel better. But I do find it helps in so many different ways. And in fact, you know, the linguistics was probably the reason I got into it in the first place. I was working as a radio presenter and I was fascinated in how you could change your language to be more communicative and perhaps more persuasive and more effective in your communication with other people and also with yourself, and change some of that, you know, that negative self-talk that kind of nags away.
Yes.
And I thought, I've got the perfect place to try this out here, because I'm presenting a daily radio show in Manchester here in the UK. And I started, it was like a 6-month NLP course. And I started to apply the skills of NLP on my daily radio show to, you know, try and get more listeners and get them listening for longer and also get them to have a better time while they were listening.
So what did you do? What was like an example of something that you...
I would make my language much more descriptive. So I would use all the senses. So rather than, perfect example, I was just telling you about how I was in the jungle. And rather than just say, I stayed at this jungle retreat and it was awesome, I used language that appealed to the visual sense, the auditory sense, and the touchy-feely kinesthetic sense. So I said, oh, you know, there was nothing more to worry about in the morning than the sound of the birds chirruping outside the log cabin. That was the kind of the hearing sense. And then I talked about, you know, dipping in the pool, which is the kind of kinesthetic sense. And I talked about the beautiful kind of surroundings, which would be the visual sense. So kind of trying to make the stories that I tell much more sensory and engaging, but also, you know, more persuasive in terms of the effective kind of communication that I was using. So you might offer someone an either or response to a question rather than say, would you like to listen tomorrow? They might say yes, or they might say no. Or you might say, I don't know whether you want to listen tomorrow at 2 o'clock where we'll be doing X, or at 4 o'clock where we'll be doing Y. You know, both of those options are the same kind of thing. And to me, you know, as long as I was doing it with the best of intentions, which was to make my listeners feel good, then that was great. And it seemed to work really well. And actually what was really interesting was after a couple of months, there was one particular day when I'd been really layering on the communication skills. I was only just learning these kind of language skills. And the boss called me into his office and he sat back and he put his legs up on the table and he kind of put his hands behind his head. And he kind of had a really kind of alpha male pose. And I thought, oh no, he's definitely rumbled me. I've been using these techniques and I'm going to get into trouble for it. And he said, I don't know what you've done, but your listening figures have gone through the roof.
Wow.
And he said, you know, on most radio stations, the breakfast show has the most listeners on every station. But on our station now, the drive time, your show, has more listeners than the breakfast show. So he said, what have you been doing? And I was like, don't worry about it. Just a few things.
You didn't fess up.
Yeah, I didn't fess up. But it was great. You know, and that was the first indication for me that this stuff could have a really powerful impact with other people and also with myself.
It sounds like it's become something, you slipped it right into the story you told at the beginning of the podcast just now. Is it something that is unconscious for you at this point?
Some. I mean, you know, some of the stuff's unconscious, some of the stuff is conscious, and I'm constantly reappraising everything that I've learned and, you know, checking that it's still kind of relevant. So yeah, some of the language stuff, I guess I am a professional communicator and obviously I work here at one of the biggest sports channels here in the UK. So I give a lot of thought to communication.
Yeah.
And yet I always think, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot that stuff on, you know, whatever it might be that I haven't read up in a while. And so I haven't got that kind of recency of thinking about it in my mind.
Yeah, well, pretty cool. So somebody out there that's thinking about trying it and they haven't read too much and they're just, you know, trying to change something in their life. Do you have a trick or a tip or a starting point that you could offer?
Yeah, well, I mean, the third book that I wrote was called Persuade in a Minute. Mm-hmm. By the way, just before I tell you about Persuade in a Minute, I have to say that one of the things we always say, have you done NLP practitioner training?
I haven't done the training, but I have read extensively about it.
Yeah.
I'd like to do it though.
I think you would. Yeah. I mean, one of the first things they say in NLP training is that they say, look, you know, you must always use the skills that you learn on this course for good. Mm. Okay. You know, it's very important when you're learning skills on how to communicate with other people and yourself that you do them in a very, you use them in a very ethical way. And I think that's really important to use to remember as well.
Yeah. Agreed.
So my book, Persuade in a Minute, the first chapter was called Three Magic Shortcuts to Get You Started. And I talked about the magic touch and about changing position when you're sitting at a table with someone, and also the most persuasive word in the world. So which one do you want to hear?
Oh, my God. That's just so they're all so tempting. how about the magic touch?
Okay, the magic touch is a good one because basically they did a survey in France. There's a researcher called Nicolas Gourguen, and he's done lots of incredible persuasion bits of research and studies. And one of them was he took over a cafe in southern France in Marseille, and he observed exactly what was going on when waitresses and waiters were at the table and what they did when they started interacting with someone and then how much their tips were at the end of the kind of interaction, at the end of the customer's stay. And he found out that when the waitresses and waiters did one single thing, when the customer arrived in the restaurant, their tips increased by around 20%.
Oh my God.
So, yeah, and it was touching a particular part of the body. Now, disclaimer here, touch the wrong part of the body and you're going to get in a lot of trouble, okay? But they found that when customers walked into this restaurant, when the waitress or waiter walked over and touched them once, very lightly, right on the elbow, that alone increased their tips by, I think it was about 20%.
Elbow. I was like totally waiting for you to say shoulder.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think the reason they found it was elbow is because they found that it was intimate enough to make a connection without being so intimate that it felt like someone was invading your body language and invading your personal space.
Yeah, makes sense because, you know, a tap on the shoulder is, you know, it happens so often that you probably wouldn't pay that much attention.
Yeah, exactly. But I love that. And, you know, every once in a while, I kind of remember it, but just, you know, for all your listeners, touch them in the wrong place and be responsible for your own actions. And
right.
I think, is it touch on the forearm for 1 or 2 seconds, you know,
wow.
Because the forearm is either the forearm or the elbow is not considered an intimate part of the body, but it is considered just enough to make a connection.
Fascinating. I love it. I love NLP. Thank you for sharing these tips. And
that's, by the way, that's not really NLP, actually. It's just a persuasion study.
Got it. So, Tony, this podcast ultimately is about authenticity, and I'm dying to dive into the heart of the show with you because you've obviously had such a tremendously successful career at Sky Sports and 3 books, and now you've got the podcast going. And you're somebody who got challenged on this whole question of, you know, having a ton of success and then getting sick and re-examining what it meant to you. So I'm curious, what does an authentic life mean to you?
And I think that's a really interesting question for us to discover, particularly as I can tell your authenticity speaking to you. And I think, you know, sometimes in the podcast world, a lot of podcasts are based around achievement, but not necessarily doing that with authenticity.
Right.
We have a word in NLP terms, which is congruence. So when you are congruent with your actions and your words and everything kind of works in harmony with each other, that is a very good state to be in. And to me, authenticity means congruent when my actions match my words and also my values. And then the other thing is that I like to, with clients or when studying someone who's been successful, you can study them at different levels. And if you're studying, it might be someone that you know, or it might be someone who's a historical figure who is particularly successful, or it might be a celebrity in the public eye, or it might be an entrepreneur. You can study them at the level of environment and capabilities and also behavior, you know, what they do on a day-to-day business, what they have for breakfast, what the first 90 minutes of their day looks like. And you often hear a lot of podcasts will ask these kind of questions, and I think that's really useful. But then if you dig it a little bit deeper, and this is the thing that not many podcasts ask and not many coaches ask, but you say, okay, what do I want to learn about this person? What values do they have? What beliefs do they have? And what is their identity? What do they believe about themselves to be important? Let's take Richard Branson, for example. If you can start to work out what his values are and what his beliefs are, and then apply some of that to your own life, I think that's where you can start to make a really significant impact and start to learn from other people more.
That's awesome. I totally agree. And your path to authenticity, was the turning point moment the moment that you were sick, or is it something that you have a different story for? Or how, what is your path in having an authentic life look like?
Well, Laura, I don't think I was living an inauthentic life before I got ill. I mean, that's the thing.
Well, some people have these major crash moments. Yeah. So that's why I'm asking. Yeah. Some people, you know, just completely cut themselves off from what was meaningful to them and then have a break point.
Well, that's actually a really good point, because I do feel personally that getting ill forced me, and often you'll find this is, you know, when something major happens to someone, as you said, that's when you really start to reassess. For me, it forced me down a kind of rabbit hole of learning more about myself. And for what really worked for me, have you ever had anything on emotional freedom therapy on your show?
No, I haven't.
EFT, tapping. It's so powerful. It's brilliant.
Oh, the tapping solution.
Tapping.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I haven't had it on, but it's so powerful.
Oh, it's brilliant. And, you know, after having spent a couple of months off work, I was like, okay, I'll try anything. And I found this guy online who specialized in fatigue, and he also specialized in NLP and tapping, EFT. And I was like, okay, all this tapping stuff, it sounds totally woo-woo. I'm not really into all that. But, you know, he specializes in fatigue, so I definitely want to go and see him.
And by the way, it is the most woo-woo thing out there. I mean, this was one that took me a while to get my brain around, but it's so cool.
Well, it sounds woo-woo, but I'm really not a woo-woo person. And for me, it's worked better than just about anything.
Yeah.
And I use it still all the time. And the theory is that, you know, a lot of emotions that we have live a little bit trapped inside our body. And when we don't connect or express our emotions, that can result in all kinds of mental and physical ailments. In fact, it would help us to get ill, but also it can't help us live a rich and fulfilled life living in the present when we've got all these trapped emotions that we can't kind of identify with. So I was obviously feeling particularly upset about the fact I was ill. There was so much emotion there. And believe me, it all came out within about 10 minutes of going to see this guy. And since then, you know, starting to explore my emotional reaction more to things that happen now, the significant events that have happened in my life, which I might not have connected with quite as effectively as I could have done in the past for whatever reason. That's been an amazing learning curve for me to really connect with these emotions. And I would recommend it to everyone to try out. And the great thing about it is, I know it sounds woo-woo, but you can Google EFT or tapping now, and you can be trying it on your own in the next 10 minutes. You can come back to Laura and I in 10 minutes time if you want to have a good tap, or you could tap while you're listening to us.
Yeah, and it's really just taking the concepts of acupressure, acupuncture, and putting them into a practice you can do at home. So it's not completely off the deep end.
Yeah, exactly. It's the acupressure points that are closest to the skin. So you can tap them and you can start to release emotion. But then what happens is at the same time, you connect with this thing that is worrying you. So if something's really stressing you out or worrying you or making you anxious, try this tapping, thinking about that thing while you tap on these 8 or 9 points that you can find online, and just see if it helps you to start to connect with it and then release it a little bit. It might help to shift something. And it's really cool for me. So in terms of the authenticity, I started to think, wow, there's a lot more to explore, which I haven't kind of come to grips with yet. So that was pretty cool.
Very cool. And you've hinted at some of the things that you do for daily practices and your habits for keeping an authentic life. Any other things? You've mentioned NLP and EFT. When you're stressed, when you're facing decisions, when you have a busy life, how do you stay in an authentic space when it starts to get a little stressed?
I definitely try to simplify and do less now. And I briefly mentioned that I meditate, and you know, my meditation practice is in its infancy. But in NLP, we have self-hypnosis, which is a similar kind of thing. Anything that allows you to step back a little bit, and that's been such a big theme on my podcast as well. People coming on Zestology and saying, look, you know, if you want to achieve more, do less, which is so counterintuitive, isn't it? But I found that in terms of a daily practice.
Yeah.
You know, I was working on the sports show today, came back, had a really nice 20-minute meditate and felt fine. But I was so tired when I got back. I didn't sleep very well last night. Felt tired. 20 minutes later, I felt like I'd had an hour and a half's nap and I was ready to go to talk to you. So, you know, that's something that in terms of a lifestyle practice really makes a significant impact. And then I do something that I call the 0.07 commitment as well, which is I take 0.07% of my day, which by the way is 1 minute, and I make a little plan on when I'm going to do some of the things that involve technology. So it might be, okay, I'm going to check emails at 11 and 3, and I'm going to do personal web time at 7 o'clock in the evening. And the rest of the time, I'm going to focus on writing my book or going to the TV channel or whatever it might be. And just by taking that 0.07% of my day, just to set out a little bit of a plan at the start of the day, I'm almost kind of making a commitment to simplify and focus, because life is so full of distractions and we're just not built to concentrate on more than one thing at once, are we?
No, we're not. And meditation is something that comes up over and over and over on the show. If you haven't tried it, it's just to, it's simply to quiet your mind. I mean, it's the most basic of things in principle, but it's life-changing. And yeah, this idea of managing your time a little bit. So when you set up this 1 minute check emails at these times, how did you start that process to get it going into your life? Because I think a lot of people struggle with the inception point.
Yeah, I mean, it's look, a daily practice and a regular practice. And I have lots of things to do on a daily basis. And meditation isn't actually something I do on a daily basis. But working out how to manage my time is something that I give an awful lot of thought to. And I think when it goes wrong and we don't manage our personal time effectively, it's such a shame, isn't it? You know, the other day I was playing football with friends, and in the middle of our game, a friend's mobile phone went off. And rather than just ignore it and get on with the football game, he ran over to the side of the pitch, answered his phone, and he was like, hello? Yeah. I'm just playing football. Yeah. All right. I'll call you when I'm finished.
Right. It's like, you know, couldn't that just wait?
It's not very relaxing for him, and it's not very relaxing for us either.
Yeah.
And not only that, the irony is that, you know, he probably spent all week looking forward to that moment when he could get together with his friends and play football. And yet he interrupted it to take a call that he probably didn't need to take.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so maintaining focus on one thing at a time, the way that I practice it, and this is the practice that has lasted, is I switch my phone off and I switch all technology off for at least 2 hours every day. And most of the time, those 2 hours are the best 2 hours of my day.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And it's weird because I actually started tracking it, because I'm well into tracking. I'm a bit of a geek, Laura, and I track a lot of things. I track my energy levels over the course of almost a year. And I found on the days that I switch my phone off and switch everything off for a couple of hours a day, my energy levels increase. But on the days that I switch off for 8 hours or more, which I know is a lot, switching off for 8 hours, some people can't do that. Because, you know, you might have to check the computer at work, or, you know, might have to be on call for your kids or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But if you can switch off for 8 hours a day, like I did occasionally, for me, my energy levels went up 20% on average when I did that.
I believe it. You know, I'm a mother, and so I have this anxiety. I can't turn my phone off. And one day it broke, right? So I had to go to Apple, and I had no choice. My child was much younger, and I gave Apple my phone. And I walked out of there literally dancing down the street.
Yeah.
It was like I had full permission. There was no way for me to check. And I spent a couple hours downtown in Chicago, wandering around, and nobody could find me. And I'm old enough that, you know, I remember life when, you know, there were no cell phones. You went downtown, you did things, people didn't find you. And you know what? The world kept spinning, you know, and it's become almost like I've become obsessed, right? It's like, what if something happens? What if somebody needs me? So I love that suggestion. And ever since that day, I try to turn that phone off, get a little time and get some space.
Yeah, and it's easy to I mean, you've got to remember that most of the things that we love the most in this world don't involve screens in the first place, you know. And as you say, I've been around for millions of years and we've only had our phones for about 10.
So it feels like forever.
You know, I went to the beach yesterday because we had a public holiday yesterday here. And I've got to say, Laura, it was probably the ugliest beach I've ever been to in my life.
What do you mean?
Well, it was this place called Whitstable in the UK, which is actually a beautiful place. But I don't know why. It was very windy and the tide was very low. And basically, the sea and the beach, it was all a kind of brown color. So, but I still absolutely loved it. You know, but I switched my phone off all day and the kind of, you know, the smell of the sea air and a really long walk and great conversation. And we had lovely food and we listened to music on the road trip on the way there and back. All those wonderful things that didn't involve and didn't need any screens. It was just, you know, reconnecting with the things that are really important. So that was a nice treat for me yesterday to remember. And in general, 8 hours a day, 20%. I mean, even if you only did that once a week, to increase your energy levels by 20% on that given day would be pretty cool.
Yeah. And study after study shows when we spend some time in nature, get fresh air, even feel the ground underneath us, our productivity goes up, our moods increase. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just a question for you, Laura. You said that, you know, you're a mom and you don't like to switch off your phone because you might want to be on call in case someone needs to get in touch with you or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But there are certain settings sitting on the iPhone where you could set it up so only certain numbers could get through to you.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Or you could easily switch off the 3G or the 4G.
Right.
So just, I mean, you know, this is because I'm always looking into, well, you know, for instance, I use traffic apps when I'm in the car, but I don't want all notifications coming through to me. I just want to know what's going on with the traffic, you know? So It's about how to manage it. And I think Apple and the other companies are getting more sophisticated at realizing that we don't want this bombardment of kind of notifications and excitement all the time, because it serves as a little dopamine hit. And I guess that's what makes these phones effective in the first place, but it ends up leaving us totally overstimulated and frazzled out.
Oh, Tony, when I owned a company and sold it and I left eventually. And in 24 hours, I found myself without any emails, right? The email from my office had been shut off. And Here I was with my BlackBerry and it would still flash red because I would get like a Gap ad or something. And I was compulsively still looking because I was just so addicted to that little red blinking light. And I were, you know, so eventually I just turned off the function that does that, right? So I think those kinds of tricks can make such a big difference in your day-to-day life.
And actually, I went on holiday to Puerto Rico a few weeks ago, and then I went to New York afterwards. And obviously, you know, my day job is working at Sky Sports here in the UK, but then running the business and the podcast and the books and everything else, a fair amount of emails tend to come in. And even on holiday, you know, you do see those kind of bleary-eyed couples walking to breakfast, getting their food, and not talking to each other the whole time while they're there, but just, you know, checking their phones at breakfast, for example.
Totally.
I didn't want to be like that. So I discovered that in the settings on the iPhone, I could very easily click on settings and then iCloud and then mail and just switch my mail off. So even if my wandering fingers just idly went and tried to open the email, it wouldn't let me because it looked like it was deregistered. So I checked my email once a day for about 15 minutes, got it all done. And then the rest of the time was just fully focused and present on the holiday. And I've taken that practice into day-to-day life here now. So if I tried to open mail on my phone right now, I wouldn't actually be able to access my mails because I don't need to.
Oh, Tony, you're motivating me. I'm going to get off this podcast and I'm going to figure
you're
out how.
Motivating me as well.
I'm going to figure out how to get it so it's the one number from my son's school and take a major phone holiday. If people are interested in your work, they want to learn more about your amazing new podcast or your books, where can they find more about you?
Well, you can Google Zestology, which is my podcast. And when you do, you'll hear Laura on my podcast because we're about to record that now, right?
Oh, that's right.
So don't go off straight away and start like trying to hide all the 3G settings on your phone. I need you focused for another hour.
Perfect. Thank you, Tony. Yeah. This has been amazing. You've brought so many incredible ideas and honesty to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming
on. It's been great to be on. Thank you.